Our lunch speaker today is Len Chapman. He's a resident scholar at Resources for the Future, which is an organization that's one floor below us. He has formerly on the faculty of Computer Tech, where he also served as director of the Virginia Water Resources Research Center. He has served as a staff economist at the U.S. Water Resources Council and a scientific advisor to the Assistant Secretary of Army Civil Works. Len is currently a member of the National Research Council and has served on NRC committees on watershed management and compensating for wetland losses. His present research includes permitting for water supply projects, the history of and prospects for private mitigation banking, as well as water quality standards setting and development of evaluation protocols for large-scale ecosystem restoration projects. Len's going to talk for, well, do you have a few proposals for what the large-scale ecosystem
I'll talk for 10 minutes or 15 minutes.
And then some Q&A?
Yeah.
Okay. And then we want to be able to reserve enough time that we can
for 10 minutes
to have another break before we come back here at 12:20.
Okay, thank you. We have another option to be talking. This book, which everybody's seen, I was the vice chair of the committee, and if anybody wants me to tell you what it means, I'll be glad to try. Because anybody that knows how NRC committees work, at the end of the day, like two people write it, so you're looking at one of them. So if you want to know why that's a comma and not a period, I can maybe answer that. So I will be glad to, see if I can add anything to what's in there. I purposely chose not to be here too much and listen to your discussions, because when I do that, I then want to comment on everybody's, try to help or whatever. Knowing this topic, it's not entirely clear how one helps. So I'm going to instead take a shot at giving you sort of a blend of what's in the report and my own views about what I'll call four ideas or four pillars or whatever for a watershed approach to compensatory mitigation, which is the title of this symposium. It's not a title. The title is not watershed planning. I'm going to be very brief, and hopefully we'll have time to talk and I can elaborate. The NRC report, we had a lot of discussion about this, how broad it was about compensatory mitigation. Not about permitting, not about planning, not about anything else, about compensatory mitigation. And the notion was that's why you're here, that should all be thought, that idea should be placed in a watershed context. The report did not argue, as I will illustrate in a moment, that there was a need for or necessarily even a requirement for formal watershed plans to do that. Our message was to think and decide in terms of larger spatial and temporal scales. And we did not say this could only happen through formal planning processes, and I'll elaborate on that in a moment. This said, it's been a while since the report, and I'll read from it, but how much of what we intended, how much of what I think is right or wrong about some of the things in it is going to get blurred. So I am not representing the committee, to put it that way. And I'm sure Joy would be more than happy to hear me say that. A couple of points then. The first, I want to make a point for context. Within the 404 ever-changing jurisdiction, the permitted acres that we worked with are reported to be somewhere filled, or permitted for fill, or somewhere in the nature of 24,000 acres per year, with a claim that compensatory mitigation are reported to be in the 2-to-1 range. We had no reason to dispute those numbers. What we said was that, and what the committee said, was that there was a concern that functions weren't being replaced, not acres. And we then went on to say, but actually we don't know, because we have no idea what's being permitted, and we have very little idea what the condition and nature of what's being compensated is. So even if you knew what the success rate was on compensatory projects, you didn't know what you were compensating for, because we're not keeping track of the functional aspects of things. So I want to emphasize that, therefore, I want my comments here are focused on function and the notion of watershed approach within the notion of function. I probably should have said at the outset, I'm an economist and have been unapologetically ever since my first paper on wetlands in 1974. So I'm an economist who knows something about wetlands, and I like to think enough to be not quite dangerous, but at least informed. And so I'll use some economic language to try to get across the points I want to make. The first is watershed thinking means focusing on compensating for valued wetland functions and not area. And that has some really important, to me, implications. Wetlands are like a natural capital asset, and assets yield services. And you value an asset for the services it yields, not for the asset itself. Think of your car. It's an asset you own. Why do you value your car? Transportation, prestige, if it's a nice car, safety, services that flow from it. Similarly, we ought to be thinking of wetlands in that regard. The terminology that this community uses is valued wetland functions. The report talks about that. I'll just summarize very briefly. We talk about a hydrologic function, a water quality function, sediment trapping, nutrient cycling, and a habitat function. And the values of the functions differ with regard to their importance. Their importance differs with regard to landscape location, position. In other words, if you're downstream of an existing wetland that's doing flood attenuation, that matters to you. Okay. And if you move that, the person downstream may not be happy if you move that function. But they also differ with regard to the ability to replace the functions with out-of-kind and even non-wetlands compensation. So it seems to me that the off-site, on-site, in-kind, out-of-kind debate in the water is clarified by a watershed approach and by thinking about compensating for functions. My instinct is that for the hydrologic and water quality functions, the compensation should probably be located as close to the impact site as possible. But this said, the form of the compensation should be quite flexible. Stormwater ponds with fringed cattail marsh around them, low impact development, Ken Potter will tell you more about that, buffers are all suitable compensation for those functions, because we're thinking function, we're not thinking wetland. The habitat function, on the other hand, is the one that should be the most mobile across the landscape. If you talk about people talking about failures, most of the failures they talk about are mostly about the habitat function. The ability to support habitat and to add wetlands to a landscape mosaic is really what we're talking about. And that's why it's likely that the habitat function probably should be off-site and probably should be of a kind that fits best in the site location, not what was. If you've moved it, it ought to be what fits in that new location, not what was where you permitted to fill. So indeed, what may be more appropriate is thinking not at watershed, when we talk about habitat, but even at ecoregion scales, or larger scales even than small watersheds. So the second thing I want to emphasize, and I've already alluded to it, is watershed thinking about functions is the foundation for considering out-of-kind compensation. I gave you a flavor of that with the water quality and hydrologic functions. Let me say a bit more about the habitat function. How do you make this operational? That's the real problem. This is a day-to-day problem you face. Okay, fine, I'll move the habitat function, but what does that mean operationally? How do I decide that what I gave up is equivalent, the equivalency problem? As a practical matter, I think functional assessment, which the report has quite a bit on, but I'm not convinced that it's exactly the way we need to go. It can be cumbersome, quite controversial. It seems to me that for the hydrologic and water quality functions, to go back to this equivalency there for a moment, there are today or will be soon a suite of models applicable at different scales, as well as rules of thumb that are applied in the TMDL program or will be applied in stormwater management, applied in water quality, and so forth. And we have rules of thumb that will allow us, if you just talk to your colleagues in other parts of the environmental management program, where people are trying always to figure out, you know, what is the net impact on the hydrologic regime of different kinds of impervious cover and so forth. Some of those tools can be used, I think, to try to calculate and what in fact would be equivalency for the hydrologic and water quality functions. You don't have to do it all with the wetlands tools that you have. But for habitat and wetlands, and here's, and this is a little tricky with streams, so I'll stick with wetlands for the interest of time. The basic message is get the hydrology right in the chosen landscape setting, and then it seems to me rely on self-design. If that's what it's, you know, you got the watershed, you've got the hydrology right, so you're going to get a wetland, and then let the thing self-design. Restoration for compensatory mitigation is not gardening. That's kind of the message. And I think it's a message, and I'll read to you, in the interest of time, I'm not going to, but if you force me to, I'll read a paragraph or two from the report that I think endorses what I just had to say. Now, when we get more radical and talk about replacing, really something radical, from a habitat standpoint, we're going to replace wetlands with riparian buffers. Then I think it's a little trickier to figure out what the equivalency will be. A point I skipped over, and I guess I meant to make, was that if we look at habitat and think about self-design hydrology, we can kind of go acre for acre. We can use an acre here, an acre there, and our unit of compensation can be physical space, as long as we've thought about it in those terms. If you haven't detected it by now, what I'm trying to do is suggest that there are some very practical ways to think in a watershed way that don't require a plan. So if somebody's sitting down trying to figure out what to do with a permit, There's some rules of thumb that you can use. Must have hit a sore spot. Some rules of thumb that you can use to think through what it means to take a watershed approach. Okay, let me talk about plans. Now, first of all, I wrote here, my note here says, beware of written plans. That's probably too strong, and I don't really mean that. What I really mean is this. I think the most successful planning products are guides to judgment. That must be made on a case-by-case basis, and they do not seek to replace that judgment. And I'm going to use an example or an analogy. Didn't ask me what watershed I live in. The watershed I live in doesn't exist anymore. I live in Roslyn, Virginia, if anybody knows where that is. And there's probably something there. I know there's some drain ditches. But I'm at the tail end of what's called the Roslyn-Ballston Corridor, which won EPA's first Smart Growth Award. It's interesting to note how the county does this and what their plan is. What's the Arlington County plan for the Roslyn Baltic Corridor? How do they implement it? It's not a Euclidean zoning map that says, here's what goes here, here's what goes there, this is going to be a store, this is going to be a residence, this is going to be so many stories high. It's actually kind of, there's a little bit of that, but what it really is a set of rules and concepts related to things like, we want always at the margin to be maintaining residential commercial balance. We're always going to be focusing on the affordable, unaffordable, I guess is the opposite, housing mix, mostly unaffordable there. The relative friendliness of the design to auto versus transit versus pedestrian versus bicycle. And they're making this up in some sense as they go along with each new development proposal in the context of what's happened, in the context of a set of rules, and it's the rules and the way to think that constitutes the plan. It isn't some written document. And I think that it's important to think about that, this is the one thing I will read from the report, and then I'll make one more comment in closing, but first I have to find it, if I can. Yeah, I think to me, personally, the biggest frustration that I've had with regard to the report is people have assumed that the watershed approach meant these plans. And we went on and on for pages, to be precise, pages 144 through 149. And in the report, that's five single-spaced pages, okay, in which we said the following. I'll just give you the highlight. Implementing a watershed approach does not mean writing a plan that is expected to guide permitting decisions, or that means all decisions. To call for a watershed approach is only to recognize that management of wetlands types, functions, and locations requires structured consideration of watershed needs, and I'm not going to repeat, you know what it kind of says, and then setting up the context for banks and so forth. And then it concludes at the end, well, it doesn't conclude, sort of in the middle, it says, watershed planning for wetlands will need to proceed without formal written plans. Instead, reliance on professional judgment of staff from multiple agencies must set watershed priorities and be the form of wetlands planning, given current agency time and resource limitations. And then it goes on, and I won't read it all, to talk about interagency coordination, cooperation, annual meetings, just talking it through as a way to do planning. And we made that recommendation largely in part because we thought it was an unrealistic expectation to expect that everywhere there'd be these plans. Also, we didn't think it was even reasonable to think that all these resources ought to go into planning wetlands. There's bigger things. But finally, also, the Arlington County model comes to mind. You know, it's really a rolling process of structured discussion and best professional judgment that really is the ultimate goal of planning, with one exception. And here I want to talk let me see here, I don't want to lose my place either, without stealing Suzanne Clemmick's thunder on the North Carolina program, I do want to make a comment on it. There, you can imagine a situation in which you really need a formal plan. And I think the North Carolina case illustrates why. And I want to talk about why I think it illustrates that. You need a formal plan if the program that you're going to use to implement compensatory mitigation requires a plan. Now, that may sound ridiculous for me to say, but let me tell you why the North Carolina program, in my opinion, requires a formal plan, or at least a process that Suzanne will explain to you. Recognize, as the state of North Carolina has recognized, that almost all off-site compensation is going to be done by third parties, private mitigation bankers. They actually don't like to call themselves that anymore down there. They like to refer to it as mitigation suppliers. Fair enough. And there's a good reason for that, because of the way the program's involved. Or, you know, the Nature Conservancy, the NLUFI programs, whatever it is. So you're going to be... And these third-party providers need to have some context to know where the demand's going to come from, what is it going to be, you know, what if they're going to make investments, they need to know, you know, where should I make the investments, how much should I invest in, how many credits should I produce, where should they be, and so forth. I've got, and there was a handout apparently, I didn't realize, I thought, I guess Ken told me you guys got it, there was a piece that Paul Scodari and I wrote that was in the National Wetlands Newsletter. Oh, okay. Anyway, in there we describe a process which is actually being adopted slowly and with, to me, with great interest in North Carolina about bidding out for turnkey projects. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of learning going on. But basically, the private sector, basically, the state of North Carolina puts out RFPs and then asks whoever wants to bid to provide these services, which are compensatory mitigation activities, that says here, you know, here's the general area we want them in. And here are the quality rules. Imagine the MBRT process written into an RFP process. Okay, but in order for the state to do that, they need a plan. They need to know where are going to be the demands. Which watersheds, what places do we think we're going to need these credits? And part of that is tying, in the case of North Carolina, tying the planning to the planning of the Department of Transportation, which is where most of the program is tied to right now. So here we have a situation where in order for this compensatory mitigation strategy to work, where you're trying to encourage people to compete on quality and price to provide you with credits, you need to have a mechanism to send information to them so they can make prudent investments. You don't want, and that's where the planning comes in. The plan becomes very important to make that function work. And so think about the function and then decide how formal the plan needs to be. That's all I have to say. I'll be happy to engage in any questions. And I'm sure Bob Brumbaugh has a question.
Eric, I'm not sure if I misunderstood you, but I guess I would maybe take a little bit, or request a little bit of a clarification.
Take exception.
Yeah, I was going to say that, but no. I'll wait to decide whether I'm going to take exception. The concept of, you know, you used an example that the hydrologic functions could be replaced in a certain way on site and the habitat functions could be replaced. So essentially, conceptually, you're sort of splitting a wetland into kind of a set of functions.
Right.
Okay. I think probably it may be important to sort of ask before that. You talked about the services it provides. It's really the services it provides for who or for what, because hydrologic function can mean, you know, different things. It can mean hydrologic function for human benefit, which may be a stock pond, a water quality pond or stock pond to replace, but it can also mean hydrologic function in its ability to support sort of the characteristic flora and fauna of that wetland, which is a very different type of hydrologic function, and I would argue could not be replaced by building, you know, a stock pond or
that's yeah, and all I'm saying is that I'm trying to come up with something practical. Here's what seems to me. Here's 100%. Here's why I say what I say. There's a lot of talk about. The committee said, well, we're very upset that
some of these compensation wetlands are fringe cattail ponds. And my thought on that is, well, yes, but if I want to hold stormwater, maybe that's pretty good. But if I want to do something for habitat, no good. That's, I think, kind of what you're saying. But then the problem becomes, but a lot of these ponds were in highly developed areas, and the ability of those areas, it's the landscape mosaic problem. Putting that pond, trying to maintain habitat in the middle of Roslyn, if you will, okay, it just doesn't make sense. And so I think that the problem you have is one of practicality. And I hear what you're saying, and the idea, I would say that what you want to do is take exactly what you said about the hydrologic function. I'm talking about function. Let me make one other point. The wetland that you move off-site for habitat could easily provide water quality and hydrologic functions. All I'm saying is you've got to protect the people downstream, if you will, if you start moving things off-site. And I think the tension of trying to protect the people downstream, which is the on-site in-kind logic, I think that's what it's about, versus recognizing that isn't going to work for the habitat function. We've got to break that tension. And the only way I can think of, and if anybody's got a better way, I'm more than happy to hear it, the only way to break that tension is to think about what you're trying to accomplish. And that's, I'm kind of rambling around with it. That pond is compensatory mitigation only for one function. I'm severing the functions. Yeah. The compensatory mitigation package is the pond, a payment to the North Carolina in lieu fee program that's putting a program that's putting habitat somewhere else, and some other.
I have Steve and then Rich.
I guess this is an observation. When that report was in the process of being prepared, I've seen parts of it, and I noticed that there was opportunity for a less than 1-to-1 mitigation ratio, and the situation I was involved with, the applicant essentially said, well, we can put our footprint into the degraded habitat and compensate on site by making a super wetland, if you will, all functions for all. Seems to me that's kind of a risky road to go down. There's probably some point of no return, you know, that you can't get to. It kind of gets to, you know, trading functions a little bit, but I'd like to hear more about that. That's a little scary, I thought.
Yeah, actually, I'm trying to remember. I think there is a place in the report, it might just be a throwaway line, that basically says that if you think about lift as opposed to acres, I'm just trying to remember, enhancement, that basically if you think about function, then you can actually have less than 1-to-1 on acres and get lift. My personal opinion is I'm probably more on your side. My view is that I believe you assess the functions in the way I've described, and that you compensate one for one on the hydrologic side. Acres don't matter in my model, in my mind. Acres only matter on the habitat end. That's what I'm getting at, okay? And so I that's what I would argue. And I think that the problem with that statement is if you don't break the functions, then I can see where you're concerned, that you wind up, you're getting some lift for something, but you're still losing space. And, you know, the no net loss means more than that. So that's...
It turned out that the wildlife would be able to ride inside.
Yeah.
If it was fully compensated for the size, it didn't matter for water quality.
But to try to... This discussion, both questions relate to the, I think, a more basic point, and that is we're talking watersheds here. We're talking about thinking at a larger spatial and temporal scales. And yet we're not talking plans. I mean, that's kind of the... And that's the way the committee kind of that's how that discussion came about. We'd have conversations like this, and somebody said, well, what's the organizing principle here? And the principle was spatial and temporal scale.
First, with your example, there's an operational glitch in your story about, well, we can actually mitigate on-site keep the water quality functions there, maybe move it off-site. The glitch is usually that occurs in a very practical sense with the development, and when the development goes in, say, for housing or residential or such, there is usually a requirement for BMPs for stormwater protection, which then a developer will say, well, I'm going to essentially create this wetland, and I should get, no, I'm required by NPDES to do a stormwater management system. This is going to be cool because I can actually build a wetland and also meet my stormwater BMPs, essentially requirements by essentially turning this wetland into a stormwater feature. So there's a little glitch there that they're getting off. Normally we would get stormwater BMPs in place, and you're essentially rolling it over into the wetland world. The second part, then,
I'm not really sure about that.
I mean, yeah, actually, too, there's actually a second glitch is that often stormwater wetlands in urban situations don't provide stormwater. There's like a lot of publications coming out of the
fluctuations. So,
second point is usually when you get into these, which is a changing scale here, is that there's going to be, within an urbanizing area, there would be hundreds and hundreds of these little deals of like, okay, we're going to split the habitat over here, keep the water quality here, multiply it with three different functions scattered across. And that would almost say that you need a plan in order to somehow capture all those many deals in one place to say, okay, we're going to do some trades in this watershed. We're going to swap some water qualities for riparian and for everybody to know and understand all those deals rather than a thousand.
No, I never suggested swapping functions. I said function A, do what you do with function A. Function B, function C. Let me comment on the deal. On keeping track.
Okay. Sure.
I think the keeping track is a very good point. I wasn't sure I understood the first point. We can talk about it. So I'm not ignoring it. You do have these programs. You have stormwater programs. You have impervious surface requirements in Virginia. We have into the Chesapeake Bay Local Assistance Program. We've got requirements having to do with no net increase in runoff and phosphorus load. And people can implement those programs in a variety of ways, including, by the way, in some counties, paying a fee to pay for regional stormwater facilities. But they can also do it on site, whatever it is. And they have to keep track of all of this. And so I think that that's a... So it's more than just the 404 permitter, if you will, having to keep track of all the deals. You know, you've got partners out there. But with regard to the wetlands, that's what the beauty of the North Carolina program is. Essentially what you're doing is that there's been a transfer of responsibility from the permittees, in this case the DOT and others, there's been a transfer of responsibility to another entity, in this case the North Carolina EEP program, who then transfers long-term maintenance responsibility to conservation organizations and others. So there's a series of transfers of responsibility. And so there's a legal track you follow, and you can go through a process. It's not like once you issue the permit and they're satisfied that the state of North Carolina, in this case, has gotten compensation in whatever way they want and made it available in to offset the losses for the functions you're interested in, you're out of the game. It's not your job to keep track. It's somebody else's job, and I think that the North Carolina program and other programs like them, when you start talking about in-lieu fee programs and so forth, are basically consolidating that monitoring function, or at least that long-term tracking function.
The planning process, I mean, multi-scale, it's all a series of innovative plans. It allows them to do this.
I would argue that, yeah, okay.
Look at it, she says it's
yeah, and as I said, but they also have a lot of fills. There's a lot going on in North Carolina, and there are other places where you don't need that bigger program. So anyway,
I want to hear these last two questions because we really need to be able to schedule a break before we all come back and sit down for two straight hours. So, Josh and then Molly, can I have
a quick second? I like what you said. The Bay Area, like in San Francisco, we elected not to do a plan for the region as a whole for the reasons that you said, especially misinterpretation. Instead, we created guidelines. Then we found, though, that it was the interpretation of those guidelines that had to carry forward. So there was never a plan, it became a program. We found that a lot of the guidelines reflected a wealth of experiential understanding that was very difficult to transfer to anybody else outside the group of people that put the plan together or guidelines. And so now we've realized we're having to construct some form of review body or advisory body or something like that through which projects move to get the benefits of the experiential understanding that was reflected in the guidelines. So it was a problem of misinterpretation that we sort of are up against now.
I have nothing to add to that. I think that's right. It's not that simple, but I won't add to it in the interest of time. I agree. That's a great example. But it's not get everybody together. There are people. If people start exercising judgment, then somebody's going to say, well, who made you the expert? You need to have some kind of a legitimization of the process, and that's what you've done. You've created an institutional mechanism that legitimizes the exercise of those judgments and transfers that knowledge.
Well, almost.
You're moving in that direction.
Molly and Bob, do you have to back
at 12:20? I'll stay here while during the break.
Yeah, there's plenty of time. So.
I just want to say, as a regulator, how happy I am to hear somebody here in this area talk so sensibly about what it's like for the person on the ground without a plan. And then, in fact, we do, as regulators, make decisions in the watershed with watershed concepts in mind. I appreciate your gather of understanding and elaboration of the process.
And I would, let me just add that one of the things that we're concerned about as a committee, and one of the things we recommend,
is that the nation invest in the people and not in the plants. And there's a lot of discussion in there on training, on tech transfer, and other things. Because if you're going to rely on what you just described, then and the Sanford Bay model, then you really have to be, it's about people and about education and experience, and we were concerned that that's a great recommendation, but the action item is investing in people, and we didn't think that was happening enough.
What Josh said in your comment in terms of having principles or guidance, if you will, I think you might want to mention the research that you did a few years earlier that helped inform this recommendation in terms of having outright plans versus guidelines, if you will, in terms of the success of such fund-based plans.
You know, I remember we did a case
study of several with our own twist on it. I mean, there's been a lot of case studies. And I don't know what you're exactly alluding to, Bob, but one of the things that comes to mind, and if there's more, Ed, but briefly, one of the things that comes to mind is the problem of the political and legal issues associated with putting lines on maps and declaring this is going to go here. The ones we looked at were right. The Juneau, Alaska plan, the Hackensack Meadows, and some of these that they tended to, for either political or legal reasons, it was back in the days, by the way, the property rights movement. Very strong, and the Gingrich Revolution, so that was a big issue. Yeah. Okay, it's not gone. I'll trust that.
Be very costly. Is some of that cost also because they know you've formed your.
And I guess that's what I mean. That problem goes away if you have a lot of money to buy people out. And not many of us have that. If you're fortunate to get on some gravy train and you can just go around and pay people, then it works. That's right. So
it's actually something. Ambiguity is something the friend of planning.
Well, thank you very much, Glenn.